Hey founders, this is the SaaS Boss Show, the podcast for SaaS founders in the growth stage who want to get unstuck, build high-performing teams, and get clarity about how to build a profitable startup. Every week, I interview SaaS consultants, coaches, and experts who work with dozens of startups just like yours and share their best strategies to overcome the daily challenges of growing a profitable SaaS. My name is Natalie Luniva, and I'm a growth and leadership coach to SaaS founders, and I'm also married to a SaaS founder, and I'm so pleased that you've joined us on this conversation. Hi, everyone. Today, it is my pleasure to speak to Carol Mahoney about SaaS sales and sales performance. As the founder of Unbound Growth, Carol has coached Harvard Business School entrepreneurial MBA students on sales, been featured on Sales Influencer as a woman to watch in sales, and a top sales coach. Salespeople who have been through the Unbound Growth coaching program has gone from on plan to top performance and closing the largest deals in the company history. Sales managers have coached their team to achieve over 130% of quota while increasing customer retention to over 98%. And sales executives have cut their hiring time in half and increased the success of sales hires by over 90%. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you work with three types of clients, right? The salespeople themselves, the sales managers, and sales executives?
Yes. And sales executives can also be entrepreneurs, founders of the companies themselves, because a lot of times they're acting as those sales executives and managers and salespeople.
I thought that you would put them in the bucket of salespeople, but no, you're putting them in the bucket of sales executives, right?
Well, they play all three hats, right? Because they are the executive that's in charge of figuring out the strategy. They're the manager of making sure that everything happens the way that it needs to. And they're the actual salesperson themselves that is interacting and conversing with customers and trying to solve problems. So, you know, we all wear multiple hats when we're an entrepreneur.
Got it. So I suggest that we structure this conversation into two parts. The first part is going to be really about the early stage SaaS companies who are trying to get traction and trying to get their first sales. So the founders themselves need to do manual outreach to their ideal customers to get those initial few sales. I see that in the beginning, when you're just starting, you shouldn't rely on inbound sales or SEO to get those few sales in the door. If you don't have case studies, for example, you really need to start with outbound. So even before you start developing your product, think how you are going to be doing that. And so what steps the founders need to take in order to get their first paying customers? That would be the first part. And then the second part is hiring and managing salespeople.
Yeah. And it's the first part is always seems to be the hardest. Like, how do we get those first clients, those first customers in? We're not known. There's some apprehension there. And if you're a startup founder, like, this is your baby. This is what you've spent nights and weekends and, you know, a lot of probably Red Bulls and trying to understand and figure out. And so then taking your baby and bringing it to someone and risking them telling you that it's ugly or no and facing that rejection can be very scary, very overwhelming.
Yep.
So for a lot of startup founders, the strategy that I typically recommend for them as an outbound strategy, because you're right, you can't rely on inbound and SEO to bring in those first customers. One, it's going to take a long time. And two, they're going to be looking for some kind of social proof for that to actually have some traction. And it's not that you can ignore those things, but you have to do that in tandem with how do I, in the short term, start getting some interest developed for this product that we're developing. So one of the things that I tell startup founders is that it is never too early to start reaching out to potential clients and customers. Because the thing that you can do is there's this thing that Harvard actually studied that they called the IKEA effect. So the IKEA effect is they wanted to know, will people pay more for things that they had a part in creating and collaborating, or will they pay more for something that's created for them by an expert? And so they call it the IKEA effect because they looked at customers for IKEA and those people who would go into IKEA and wanted to build it themselves versus would they pay to have someone else build it for them. Most people put more value on the things that they had a part in building themselves than they put more value on having someone else do it for them. So this strategy, the way it can work in sales for startup founders is that when you start thinking about your idea, is to start reaching out to those people who you think that it's going to help. And simply say, I've been working on something, I have this idea that I'm forming that I think will help our market or help with this particular problem. And I would love your feedback on it because you're a thought leader in this space, or I know that this is something that's really close and passionate to your heart. And I would love your feedback on what I'm thinking about building. And start engaging with them and asking them questions about what do they think about the problem that you're trying to solve? What are some of the ways that they've thought about that? What are some of the ways they've thought about solving it? What are some of the consequences of that? What are some of the things that they've tried that's worked and hasn't worked? And what you're actually doing is then saying, I love your feedback. Thank you so much for that. I'm going to take this and go back and start building it according to this feedback that you've given me. Can I keep you in the loop as to how things progress? And really, if you think about it, it's kind of like the strategy that they use for Kickstarter campaigns, where you get to collaborate on something that somebody's building and people are willing to pay money for that. You can essentially do the same type of thing to get your first 10, 20 customers, is reach out to those people, get their feedback, and keep them in the loop as the product develops and give them first access. Give them, you know, we're going to eventually charge this for that, but because you were one of the first people that helped us to build it, we're going to give it to you for X. So that you can start to build this fan base of people that feel like they have contributed to the creation of your company and your product, and they're invested in it, and they're going to be willing to then become your first paying customers. And you're going to find those early adopters are the ones that are going to be willing to continually give you feedback so you can continually innovate. You know, one of the things too that I find that a lot of startup founders struggle with is who do I turn to first? And we all have certain degrees of connections and certain levels of degree separation from those connections that we want to get to. So a lot of times the first people that you can talk to are the people that are closest to you, people you went to school with, teachers that you went to school with. If you're part of an accelerator or an incubation program, they're going to have other people that you can talk to. You know, connecting with people on LinkedIn and just people like to share what their opinions of things are. So it's not hard to find those people to potentially talk to.
And it also can be one of the challenges and problems. Like if you do not talk to your potential customer or someone who can be your potential customer, all of those well-wishers can say, yeah, that's great, or no, I would not buy something like this. So when you decide to go to your friends, be very careful is my suggestion. But yeah, then reaching out to potential customers and just get their feedback early on, without you spending all the time, month and month of coding this, and then getting to them and say, hey, I've built this, can you provide your feedback? And then the feedback that they provide is kind of, you know what, that's not the way that we do that, because you might miss a small thing that just completely changes the way that the tool right. needs to be built. So getting this feedback early on is crucial.
And getting the right kind of feedback, because a lot of times what I see is that people ask for feedback, they do this presentation and pitch and demo, and then the feedback they ask for is, so what do you think? And it's hard for people to put into words whatever it is they're thinking, because it can be all over the place. So before you start asking for that feedback from potential clients and customers, be very specific on the feedback that you're asking for. How would this impact your day-to-day in this particular functionality? Or how do you foresee that this would work in your day-to-day? Or how are you doing it now, and how do you wish that you could do it? Those kinds of specific questions are the things that are going to give you something actionable to go back to your product or to devising your sales process, so that you can not just kind of get that wishy-washy, I think it's great.
So why do you think so many founders struggle with sales, specifically at this early stage?
If you've read Daniel Pink's book, To Sell as Human, it talks about the research that he did in that 7 out of 10 of us associate the word sales with something negative. And he told the Harvard Business Review, when we hear the word sales, we tend to think of things like pushy, slimy, sleazy, cheesy, used car salesmen. And so whenever we think of ourselves of going into a sales role, we rebel against that because we don't want to be seen as that. it was interesting when I was coaching Harvard MBA students, they were given a case study and told that in the case study, they were going to then role play on a video, the buyer and seller in this particular case study. And the thing that was so interesting as I was watching these videos, the two students would come in and they would have like a normal human conversation. And then when it became time for them to slip into their buyer-seller role, they suddenly, it was like they put on capes and masks and costumes and became a totally different person. And they started sounding like a pushy salesperson. They talked too fast. They never stopped to ask a question. They immediately started discounting. By the way, that's not good sales behavior, just in case anybody's wondering. And it was because they had this mindset of this is what a salesperson should do. Because when I asked them afterwards, like, how did you think things went on your role play in the video call? They're like, oh, I think I went great. I'm like, well, what made you think that? And their response was, well, isn't that how a salesperson is supposed to act? Control the call, give the pitch, and go in hard for the close. And I'm like, no, not at all. And so because we have this mindset of what sales is, and that the majority of us have this negative mindset, when you have to go into the role, the way that we learn to do something is we model the behaviors of others that we see as successful. And even though we think that pushy, slimy, sleazy, cheesy salespeople are bad, we also see that they're successful. So we model the behavior. And so we're creating more of the thing that we hate. So we have to change the mindset. We have to change the perspective of what we think sales is and what sales behavior is. Sales is really connecting problems and solutions. It's helping people to make decisions that are in their own best interest. And that sales is really about helping people in that way. It's not about pushing your product or convincing someone to buy or manipulating, you know, their fears. It's really about helping to solve problems. And when founders take that mindset into the development of their product, that it's not about them, it's about the person that they're trying to help. And then that suddenly that dynamic of how they approach sales starts to shift. They're more inquisitive. They're more curious. They're more other focused. They're more empathetic. And sales is not this slimy thing that you have to force yourself to do. It's a human conversation. And because most startup founders that I talk to, they never got into this because they wanted to be a salesperson. And if you say that they're a salesperson, they get this look on their face like, no. I am not a salesperson. I don't want to be a salesperson, but I know I need to get customers in. So I think at first we have to start addressing the mindset of what we think sales is and then start actively finding ways to change that. That's why if you look at my LinkedIn profile, I talk about a cognitive behavioral approach. Cognitive behavioral therapy is all about changing a belief and a mindset to change a behavior. And so if we can do that at the early stages with startups, then they have much more likelihoods of success in creating good sales cultures in companies.
I talk to many founders and I love the idea that the mindset is basically where you start untangling this problem of not being able to be successful with selling the product. To anyone who is not feeling confident reaching out and doing cold outreach, if you have a solution or a tool that can help other people, it is your moral obligation to step over anything that you have, all of your concerns and reservations that people are going to perceive me as salesy or I don't want to do that because I don't want to be inconvenient to people. It is your moral obligation to get what you have in the people's hands. And that's a part of that is being uncomfortable with the sales process.
Yeah. Well, and I think that a lot of times we're uncomfortable with it. It's a rejection. There's our human need for approval. And so we don't want to do anything that people are going to think ill of us. I don't want them to think I'm a pushy, slimy, sleazy, cheesy salesperson. So I'm not going to do that outreach or any of those things. And it's absolutely true what you say, that it is a moral obligation. I often will say, are you the kind of person who sees somebody stumble on the street and twist their ankle and walk right by, or wait for them to ask for help? Or are you the kind of person that's going to immediately go over and give them help whether they ask for it or not? Going over and giving them help whether they ask for it or not, that's a warm or a cold outreach. And if you're trying to make the world a better place, then that's going to require you to do some things that you're not comfortable with in small doses. You don't have to become, you know, the the pushy salesperson overnight. You can take it in small pieces. And it can be as simple as reaching out to people and saying, hey, I'm thinking about building this for this particular problem. Would love your feedback because I know that you are passionate about this or you're well known for also tackling these kinds of issues. And start talking with people who are thought leaders in the space. What's the worst that can happen? They say no, and you'll still breathe tomorrow.
Let's talk about the goals and how do we stay productive.
If you look at it from a numbers standpoint, you want to have a certain group of or number of group of people that you can reach out to. So from a goal standpoint, if it's something that you're uncomfortable with, then start with something that's small. Come up with a number that's going to get you to where you ultimately want to be. So you can do the reverse math of, if I need to sell $10,000 worth of product and my average value is $1,000 and it takes me X number of people to contact in order for me to get to a sale, you have to start running, you have to start making those numbers and running those calls. And the thing is that everyone's like, well, what's the right number? The right number is start with one. If you can get one person a day that you talk to and start building that number from there, the next day you do two, the next day you do three, the next day you do four, as long as you're starting with something somewhere, that is, I think, ultimately the goal. You need to talk to roughly, I would say, 50 to 100 people every week in order to get to the 20 or 30 or so that are actually probably going to be good prospects for you to then be able to talk to in a meaningful way. You've got to figure out every week what those numbers are going to be for you. But start with any number and then you can figure out how many it's going to actually take you.
I love it. I've read a study done on students when they were asked to give a deadline when they're going to be submitting their assignment. Uh-huh. And so there were two groups. The first group was asked, so when are you going to submit the assignment? And they would give the date. But the second group would be asked, when are you going to be submitting the assignment? And tell me, where exactly are you going to be doing that? Imagine what date is it going to be? Are you going to be at your home or are you going to be somewhere else? So, and when the second group that would imagine where they are actually going to be, so they're going to be really specific and think through where they're going to be. And I don't remember the number, but had a much higher percentage of actually turning in the assignment on time.
Yeah, there was a study that was done at the Dominican University by Gail Matthews that talked about the likelihood of people reaching their goals. And she put participants into five different groups, and each of the groups was asked to do their goal setting a little bit differently. The first group just needed to think about it. Like, we all think about our goals. I think about the fact that I need to call 10 people today. But it was then the next step of actually writing it down. This is the actual plan that I'm going to do and putting it pen to paper. Then the next step that the other group needed to do was that they needed to make commitments. So commitments like you were just talking about, I'm going to call it this day at this time, I'm going to call this person with this message. They were making those commitments and writing those commitments down. But then the last two steps was that they had to share their written plan and commitments with someone else. And then the final step was that they needed to make regular reports to that person. And these are the steps that I have all of my clients go through when I'm coaching them, because the likelihood of them reaching their goals, I think it was like 70 something percent higher if they went through all five of those steps than if they had just thought about it. Even people that just did like step one and step two were more likely to reach their goals than people who only did step one. So each one of the steps that you complete increases your likelihood exponentially that you're going to reach that particular goal. So I actually have clients do this every week, like start off your week with what is your written plan for the week? What are your commitments for that? Sharing that and then making reports either daily or at the end of the week as to how they progressed on that and getting the specific feedback they needed for the next week so then they could tackle those set of goals again. So for startup founders, finding a coach or a trainer or a group of people that are going to hold you accountable and give you feedback to go through those five steps is going to increase your likelihood of reaching your goals. I think it was like 70, 75% in the study.
I love it. But also, do not start your planning on Monday. Start the day before or the week before that so that on Monday, you know what to do. I've listened to this audiobook, don't remember the name of it, but basically, they say that our mind is working really hard when we're asleep and unconsciously working, even if we don't think about this. So when you are sleeping or even if you're just hanging out with your friends, your unconscious mind still working on, okay, how are we going to be doing this on Monday? if you set this goal internally.
Yep. Yep. One of the modules that I do in my training and coaching is called, I call it time prioritization, because I think time management is a myth. Like, it comes and it goes. You don't really have much control over how fast or how slow it's going to happen, but you can prioritize how you spend your time. And so what I often teach clients is that there's an article I have on my blog about how I work and get SHIT done. And in it, we talk about how to, on Fridays, like, so say, for example, you come up on your Friday afternoon and you reflect over the whole week. What is it that worked this week? What have I learned? What hasn't worked? And then how am I going to take that and apply it into my next week? And what I often have clients do is then on Sunday nights, is before, like, you know, after dinner or in the afternoon, but before you go to bed on Sunday nights, is to do a dump of the week. Like, here's are all of the things that are in my head that I think that I need to do in this next week. And then out of all of those things that you've listed out in your big long to-do list, then going through that to-do list and look at who can I delegate what to? Like, what are the things that only I can do? What other things are that list that I can delegate to someone else to do? And then out of those things that only you can do, what are the priorities that are going to get you to your ultimate goals? Because sometimes, especially as startup founders, we tend to chase whatever fire is happening or whatever seems important at the time. But instead, taking your time on Sunday night to look at your week and how am I focusing on my top three priorities for growth, which is probably going to be getting customers and having those sales. And then looking at your week on Sunday night so that when you wake up on Monday morning, you know what your priorities are for the week. And when you map out your day on Monday, it's with those three priorities or four priorities for that particular week. A lot of people, what they'll do is they, like what I do is on Sunday night, here's what I need to do. Here's my time blocks in order to get that done so that I'm not feeling anxious throughout the week of, am I going to get these things done? I've already blocked the time for it in my calendar for those things that are a priority. And that way, when things that are fire drills or things that seem important come up, you can do the litmus test against your goals and what you've blocked out for the week. Is this something really urgent and important? Do I need to drop something and move something around to get this taken care of? Or is it not as urgent as everyone says it is? It's just everyone feels like it's that way. And as startup founders, when you're trying to go after those first couple of customers, that is probably the most important thing that you can be doing. Everything else is going to be a distraction. So it's a good way to keep yourself on task, focused. It's also a way to start going through those steps of goal setting and writing and committing your action commitments before your action commitments are made for you.
You mentioned reflecting on your experience from previous week. And yeah. I've read this quote, we don't learn based on our experience. We learn reflecting on this experience. And right. So reflecting on what happened in the last week or a few days is so crucial for you to know what's working and not what's not working.
Yes.
Second thing I wanted to point out is you mentioned blocking the times on your calendar. And I found this so important because it is really like putting those big stones first and mm-hmm. then the rest, the smaller things like you put in the jar. If you put first like the sand or like the gravel first, then there's no space for stones left, right? But if you put your big tasks first and you know that you need to do them, and then everything else basically going to be added to the calendar.
Yeah, or the old saying of like, how do you eat an elephant? One small piece at a time. So even those big tasks that seem overwhelming because they're so huge, is that if you take this weekly prioritization kind of framework and method, you can take your big tasks and break them up into smaller, smaller, and smaller tasks. And then when you block your time for each week, you can say, all right, this time block, I'm going to tackle this set of tasks because that'll set me up for tomorrow where I'm going to do this set of tasks. And so you can take your big chunks, make them into smaller chunks, and then sequence them so that you're starting to take those things on little bits at a time. One last thing on reflection is that, you know, as startup founders, we have to make a lot of decisions. When you're thinking about all of these decisions that you have to make and it can get overwhelming, there's actually studies that show that just 15 minutes of meditation and reflection a day puts you in a place where you're more present and able to process the information that's coming at you so that you can make decisions easier. One of the things that I tell or that I've learned, I should say, in that time blocking is to break up the chunks so that you get breaks in between. So that you get a 10 or 15 minutes to go for a walk or get a coffee and just be able to sort of like reflect and then move on to the next block of process time. Which is another thing that you can do is that when you look at time blocking, try to keep similar tasks grouped together. So for example, I have found doing sales prospecting and outreach, breaking that up into the days and times when I know that those people that I'm trying to reach are going to be available. And then I use my morning times for blocking in creativity types of things so that when you're shifting different tasks, your brain doesn't have to do as much energy in shifting between the two because the tasks are somewhat similar in nature. So block your time in small chunks, but try to keep your similar tasks together so that you don't have to do so much switching in your mind. You won't be quite as exhausted. You can build those breaks in to kind of reflect, and you'll find that your productivity increases dramatically.
To continue talking about productivity, if you know that you're productive in the morning, please do not check those emails in the morning. If you have the things that you need to work on, do not check the emails. Do not check your Slack messages or anything else. If you know that this is the 2 hours that you want to work on this, this is where you're going to be most productive. Because if you're going to start check messages or what your team tell you about, hey, this customer, we have this problem with such and such, do not go that trail.
Yes.
Start in the morning. If you're productive in the morning, start with your biggest stones and tackle that first, eat that frog, and then do everything else.
So the other thing for productivity is I actually schedule time in my calendar for when I'm going to check email, when I'm going to check social media, and I block that out. Sorry, all right, this is my half hour after lunch. I'm going to check email and respond. Because it's one thing to check email and social messages and then not do anything about it, and then you forget about it, and then 3 weeks later you're like, oh, I probably should have replied to that. So I actually block time in the morning and after lunch and then before the end of the day, and that's when I check my social media and my email messages and respond to them accordingly and then get them out of the way. That it does a couple of things. One is that it doesn't make you feel anxious because you haven't checked your messages, and so you have the time block for that. It's easy for you to be able to say, I will check that at noon today because I'm going to focus on these other tasks. And also it teaches your team and your customers that you're not going to live on your email all the time, because nobody who lives on email all the time gets anything useful done.
I would also add that it brings structure to your life, and you know that, okay, this between 8 and 10, I'm doing this. And then between 10 and 11, this is what I'm checking my emails. So basically, this is bringing structure instead of everything basically being mashed up. But now you have the structure when you are planning to do things.
Yeah. And can we just have one note about multitasking, which is a complete myth? Multitasking actually lowers your IQ. And I've actually read studies that say, for women, I think it lowers your IQ between 5 and 6 points, but for men, it's for 7 to 8 points. We actually aren't able to multitask. Our IQ goes down, we become less productive, we make more errors, it takes longer for things to get done. So focus on one thing at a time, and then switch to something else after you've completed that particular thing. I can't tell you how much sanity I would be saved if more people realize this.
So we have a few minutes left before we switch to the second part of the interview, but I wanted to touch on a couple more questions. So the first one, I want to summarize and basically give actionable advice for outreach process. And then the second part is, what are some most common problems that you see founders make when they do this outreach process?
Yeah. So actionable advice is practice the IKEA as early as you can, as soon as possible. Start reaching out to people who you believe would be your target customers that you're going to solve problems for. Tell them, I'm thinking about building this particular thing to solve this issue. Ask for their feedback. Do not sell them. Do not pitch them. Do not ask them how much they would pay for it. You're simply trying to get them to engage and give you feedback and ask for permission to keep in touch with them as it progresses until when you get to the point that you are ready for them to buy or to sell, you've already established a relationship. You've already started the sales process. Another actionable thing here is to start with, you know, your connections. Find out who is it that are in your connections that are either those target customers or can introduce you to those target customers.
What are the most common problems that you see founders make and how to fix those problems?
The most common problem that I see founders make is they go into their pitches too early. They talk all about their background. They talk all about their product. I get it. This is their baby. This is what they've been working on. But you've got to understand that most people don't care. They don't care until you find something that they care about and how it relates to that. We are all human beings, and as human beings, we are all thinking, what's in it for me? How is this going to impact me? And so the thing I see a lot of startup founders doing is they go in talking about the product. They go in talking about the opportunity, and they really need to have a awareness of how much am I talking about me and myself and my company and my product and what I want to do, and how much am I asking them about the challenges they have, the frustrations they have, how they do things now, what they wish things would be like. That's where they need to focus their conversations.
I often say that founders who are also engineers, it is their curse to be able to code, because they go into this, okay, I can develop this product, and so I'm gonna go and do that, instead of what we just talked about, doing this outreach first, ask about all the challenges and the problems that your potential target audience will have, and then based on this information, take it and start developing. But instead, what are the engineers doing? They go right into the development mode.
Yeah. So I will share a quick story with you on that. The first startup that I ever worked with, the chief technical officer, his name is Mark Patton, great guy, Canadian, super smart, loves lots of wine. And it was my first startup tech job. I was still in college, and I will never forget what he said to me in my first couple of weeks there about coding. Someone had asked him, hey, well, why don't we just do it this way? He goes, just because you can code it doesn't mean you should. And Mark was he's super smart. I mean, they created 3D and 4D interactive visualization systems for some of the biggest data sets in the world, where they would be able to map the entire ocean floor in certain areas and then be able to create these like video game fly-throughs where scientists could go through and analyze it. Like super smart, like beyond smart. But his thing was, is that he would never code anything unless he understood how it worked in the workflow of the people that he was trying to work with. He would go on the ships. He would sit next to them at their desks and see how they would go through their analysis and workflows before he decided what to code into his product. If every engineer and CTO of companies did that, the world would be such a different place.
I love it. Thank you for sharing this story. And this is it for the first part. Be sure to check out the next episode, where Carol and I talk about how to hire your first salesperson, what's the process, how to avoid the pitfalls, and how to maximize your chances of making it work. Check out the next episode. That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to the SaaS Boss Show. If you found this content interesting, I'd really appreciate it if you take just a second to leave a review on iTunes, so that founders just like you can learn about this show. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and I'll be back with another interview next week.